Cinecast is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/cinecast. And also by the new Honda Fit. The Fit is go. Grip the wheel. Rev it up. All systems go. Feel the compressed fury of the rip-roaring, lean-burning, friction-fighting 1.5-liter VTEC power plant, a 16-valve, 4-cylinder dynamo. Punch it. Let the gas hogs eat your dust. The Honda Fit.
From Chicago, this is Cinecast. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Hallgren, still in New York. Coming up on this Friday edition of Cinecast, our top five movies about America, plus listener feedback and music by Bobby Bear Jr. But first, willkommen, bienvenue, welcome to the show-stopping grand finale in our musicals marathon, Bob Fosse's Cabaret.
What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret.
Like the first film in our musicals marathon, the George M. Cohan biopic Yankee Doodle Dandy, Cabaret is not so much a musical as it is a debauchery-ridden love story with music and dance, played out against the heated political backdrop of 1930s-era Berlin. With the entertainment confined to the Kit Kat Club, Fosse is free to depict the oddly matched love affair between a decadent, American expatriate cabaret performer named Sally Bowles, played by Liza Minnelli, and the straight-laced, Cambridge-educated Englishman Brian Roberts, played by Michael York. As Minnelli, York, and a host of others living on the arty, degenerate fringe of Berlin society swill brandy and swap sexual partners, they show only the mildest annoyance at the Nazis' rise to power. In 1972, the year of The Godfather, Cabaret won 8 Academy Awards, including Oscars for Minnelli and Joel Grey as the Kit Kat Club's demonic master of ceremonies. Adam, you're a big fan of Fosse's All That Jazz, another movie about self-involved artists. If the Oscars had a penalty box, like we do here on Cinecast, making The Godfather ineligible for its Best Picture Award, would Cabaret get your vote?
Well, all I can say, Sam, is maybe. I think there's a decent shot, but considering the other three nominees that year were Sounder, Deliverance, and The Emigrant, and the only one of those three that I've seen is Deliverance, it's probably not fair of me
to... You never saw Sounder?
No, I have not. It's probably not fair for me to weigh in, but I will say, as much as I liked Joel Grey as the MC in this film, he is a lot of fun to watch. He did beat out Robert Duvall, James Caan, and Al Pacino.
I know.
You've got Bob Fosse, who I do really respect and do think is a great director. As you said, I love All That Jazz. He beat Francis Coppola for Best Director that year. So you factor those in. I'm not sure I can go that far, but I can say that I did really like Cabaret. And a big reason why is, of course, being a huge fan of All That Jazz, I did see a lot of similarities in terms of Fosse's style. And one of the big things you see, beyond obviously the dancing and the style of music, is the way he tells the story. You've got this kind of meta level that Fosse exists on, where he intercuts the story world, the musical story world that we see, with the world that's also going on outside of the Kit Kat Club. And the way he intercuts those stories, the cross-cutting between them and the jump cuts, the way sometimes we'll just get a moment where we'll flash to Joel Grey, his face or his response to something in song, is really interesting, that kind of commenting that he does. And it's something we certainly don't see stylistically in the other musical films that we've seen. The other big thing that I really found fascinating about this film is that it may be the only film. I talked about West Side Story having a great story on its own, which the other musicals, I thought, really you're watching because you like the entertainment. You like the song and dance, whereas West Side Story, the story actually grips you. Well, here you've got a case where you almost could. It wouldn't be as good, of course, but you could almost take out the songs, and it would still be an interesting story. There is real tension in this story, which is something you don't usually get in a lot of musicals, obviously, where, especially with the storyline of the Fritz character, who really is a Jew living in Germany, and he's in love with a Jew, and he doesn't know whether or not he should tell her that he's really a Jew, because then she can marry him. But obviously, he's putting his life at risk, and there is a sense of dread that we've talked about with other films. There's a sense of dread throughout this entire film, mixed in with this fun and revelry that is really fascinating. And the last point I'll make before I'll toss it back to you, Sam, is what I love about the way Fosse shoots this film is the way he makes debauchery, the way we see the debauchery of the Kit Kat Club, he mirrors that with the violence we see occurring, especially with the Nazi party. You get a lot of shots of the people in the crowd reacting to the dancers on stage and the music and the people that are doing the performing, intercut with, for example, a couple of Nazis beating someone up, beating them to death, basically, in the alley. And he shoots both of those the same way, making the characters involved all sort of grotesque. And that's the thing about Fosse, is that even though he kind of loves this debauchery and has a lot of fun with it, he's willing to put violence, I think, and the song and dance on that same kind of primal level and say that these are both human. You can then start to understand why people would eventually gravitate towards that Nazi party, because there's almost something similar about what's going on stage. There's a certain decadence to it that and grotesqueness that he equates. And I thought that was really fascinating.
Well, I wouldn't say he not only equates, I'd say he's even criticizing, really, the decadence of the cabaret and really what that represents in society. I mean, not knowing a lot about, 30s era Berlin, but at least, coming out of World War I, I mean, Germany was absolutely, financially devastated. And, what the movie sort of pits this really interesting dichotomy here, where you see really the rise of the Nazi power, of the Nazi party, and you also see this society that's absolutely taken in by the decadence of the cabaret.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I think what Fosse does is really put us in the position of, Berlin society. And, in some way, what are you going to choose? If you feel like, are you really going to choose the decadence and debauchery of the cabaret,
right?
Or are you going to choose something that's at least, and we have this really incredible and powerful moment in the film where we get this long song in an open square.
It's incredible.
A young boy,
uh-huh,
who's revealed to be part of the Nazi youth singing a patriotic song. And you see the people, the people in the square, you see their faces, and then of course you see them join in the song. And I can't say I blame them. After spending an hour in the cabaret and feeling increasingly uneasy by what takes place there. And
uh-huh,
I want to be very careful about that. I am not saying that there is an appealing quality to Nazism. I'm just saying what Fosse does incredibly well, really just brilliantly, is shoot the cabaret scenes in the exact same way throughout the film. And then yet, as you get further along, it becomes, you as an audience member, I become increasingly uneasy watching it. I find that, watching the cabaret, instead of being entertained by it, I feel a little put off by it.
Unclean?
Unclean, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help, I thought that was just, it's something, and I think it's just really masterful in terms of tone, in terms of like putting you, the audience member, in a position where you're experiencing, what takes place on the screen in an almost visceral way.
Yeah,
and,
no.
You know,
I agree completely, Sam, and I think that you highlighted the one scene, of course, I wanted to mention, because that Fatherland scene where the boy starts singing Fatherland and everyone gets into it, and they start out with a look on their face like you're not entirely sure, because you've seen people throughout the film react to the Nazis with varying levels of disgust, basically, and you see
but
them and you see that
than horror.
Well, because they're a little bit afraid, I think, too, of course, but they're at first you're looking at their faces and it's almost like they're not sure how to react. They're almost put off by it. By the end of the song that he's singing, they're all on their feet in the beautiful moment of Brian Roberts saying at the end to Maximilian, "Do you really still think you can control them?" I mean, that's such a really intelligent, just great moment where we're able to see something. Fosse shows us something that he could have told us and it wouldn't have been nearly as effective. And I know exactly what you're saying, too, where you're saying you're of course, you know, you don't want to make the mistake of saying there's something appealing about Nazism. But that is what Fosse is doing. He's showing you the two ends of the spectrum. And he is showing you, on some level, the appeal of that party. When a country is in the kind of state Germany was then, there are two ways to go. You can either, if you're just in that kind of position, you can either fall prey to the sort of decadence of the cabaret, or you can resort to better times. And that's what happens here. That's what happened, is you've got these people all of a sudden hearing a song like Fatherland. They're hearing about the greatness of Germany, the greatness of what they how they envision themselves as they once were, whether they really were or not. That's right. The way they want to envision themselves as this ideal.
Or do you want to hear, on the opposite side, do you want to hear two girls are better?
Right.
You know, do you want, in terms of, adultery and just this kind of perverse sexuality?
Yeah.
It's just like Fosse basically says, here are your choices. And you can just see, socially what happened. And I think what's really interesting is that what he also gives us is a film where Nazis appear. And we don't have anyone. We don't have a hero. We don't have anyone fighting the Nazis.
Not really.
And I want to say that's really unique. Try to think of a film where that takes place, and I think where you start to experience the horror of your protagonists.
Yeah, Brian does at one point kind of stand up.
But he seems more peeved by it.
Yeah,
I mean he does sort of stand up. Yes, he gets into a fight, but it's like. It doesn't seem so much a heroic gesture as it does annoyance.
You're right.
It's
he's
an extension of his annoyance with Sally.
Yeah, exactly. It's his personal life kind of getting the better of him. I agree. And I think that just for Fosse to have the kind of, I don't know if intelligence is the word I'm looking for or not, but the way he brings that sophistication to a film about Nazism and about really the allure of jingoism. I'm not sure that I've seen a movie, and this is a musical, which we don't give a lot of credit to for these things. We expect them just to entertain. But I'm not sure if I've seen someone really perfectly put on screen the allure of that and how you could see people falling prey to that type of thinking. It's really compelling. That's a really amazing scene, that Fatherland scene. And there's interesting things Fosse does throughout in terms of revealing information. At first, that boy is singing, and by the time they get to the Nazi swastika, before it even gets there, you figured it out, or at least I had. But at first, you don't know.
At first,
you don't know. And there's a moment, too, earlier in the film where Sally Bowles has just had her first real big romantic encounter with Brian. They're in love. And I'm sorry I didn't write down the name of the song she sings, but she goes and sings this really ridiculously powerful emotional song about maybe this time basically things will work out. Maybe this time it's for real kind of is what the song's about. Mm-hmm. And she's just singing her guts out. And then we see later in the scene, we see that shot of the crowd and we realize that she's singing to nobody. There's really nobody here to hear that song. They want to hear the other types of songs, but the type of song she's singing there, no one's there. And yet she's performing it with that same devotion and dedication as if she would to a full house. It really takes you off guard. You're really shocked by it that someone could actually be singing that powerfully to nobody. My reaction.
Which will help it bring us back to the fact that this is a musical and we watched it in the context of, five other musicals. Mm-hmm. And I think we really have come full circle here, not only with Yankee Doodle Dandy, which is more or less a drama that's interspersed with song and dance. Mm-hmm. But also, and I think one thing I mentioned at the beginning of the marathon is maybe the definition of what makes a great musical for me is those number of wow moments.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say this movie absolutely has them. And in addition to being, I think, quite a brilliant movie on its own. Money Makes the World Go Round, duet, Joel Grey and Liza Minnelli. And I realized it was the first time in the marathon I was put in a position where I had to decide who to watch, and I couldn't. These are two just absolutely incredible, charismatic performers, and they were both doing something interesting every single moment of the scene. And and Fosse's choreography is so much different than what we've been watching.
Yeah,
it's almost like bad Fosse would be what you'd see at a strip club or something. I mean, it's really just it's so sensual. It's just so. It's one step removed from everyday life or just gesture, and it's just an extension, really, of need or of just emotion.
Yeah, a desperation to it.
Of desperation, whatever. I mean, the way Liza Minnelli performs, you said she's singing her guts out, and she is. She always has her arms extended wide. Her chest is exposed. Her whole body is exposed, which is part of the whole decadence of the cabaret, what she's giving everything, and it's almost too much. But that song, just the experience of who do I watch? Do I watch Joel Grey or Liza Minnelli perform this song? I immediately wanted to watch it again, just that scene. And I feel so that alone, it qualifies as a great musical, yes, and it qualifies as a great film.
Yeah, there are a number of scenes like that, a number of great songs. I think the opening number, of course, is great. The welcome that we had there in the intro to the cabaret. And, of course, title song, Cabaret, is great as well. There are a number of great moments like that throughout. But I am curious, Sam, in general, and we probably should wind this up here, but I am curious what you think about Liza Minnelli on the whole. Mm-hmm. Beyond her singing, what did you think of her acting?
I mean, by the end of it, I really, and Carrie and I were talking about this, I can't imagine anyone else performing that part. First, she seems a little mannered.
Yeah, I mean, especially in that first scene where we meet her.
Sure, but then you realize that is the character.
Yeah.
And there was at one point, and I don't remember ever experiencing this before, later in the film, we're, you know, two-thirds of the way through, and it's really just a pretty quiet scene between Brian and Sally. And I realized that I can't imagine this script actually being written. It actually, every single word that comes out of the characters' mouths seems absolutely what they'd say.
Yeah.
And not dictated by the script or what needs to happen. I couldn't hear the script being read.
Yeah, that's
interesting. It was just like, it was really interesting. And I think, and so you have to give credit absolutely to the actors, but also to a script that is just, you said it earlier, it shows and doesn't tell. And to write that is just, that's pretty masterful. But yeah, I mean, as a performance, it is absolutely, deserves its legendary status.
Yeah, I definitely came to appreciate Liza's performance as it went on. You kind of get used to her character maybe a little bit. At first, I really was thinking, wow, Liza, you are overdoing this character. Even though you know she's supposed to be this wannabe actress, it still felt too mannered. I think that's the right word for it. But I also just briefly do want to acknowledge, I think, the performance of Michael York, who at first when you're watching it, you think, wow, you couldn't have found a stiffer British guy than Michael York.
More Germanic looking,
which is the idea. That's a good point, too. Very Aryan looking. But there are some devastating moments that he pulls off that when I'm watching an actor and asking myself whether or not I think they're giving a good performance, one of the things I ask myself is, how would someone else have delivered that moment right there? What choice would they have made? And the moment, for example, where she says, and she thinks she's being very coy and hurtful, and she says that he says, "Oh, screw Maximilian," and she says, "I do," and the pause, and that look on his face, and that laugh that he gives, and he says, "So do I," is perfect and devastating. Yeah. And there are a lot of great moments like that.
Because he's been waiting to hurt her.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and he's, you see the hesitation in him. He doesn't know how to do it.
That's exactly
right.
He has
a discomfort. And it's just, it is. It's a really, and it's, you have to give credit to Fosse, who has just a wonderful sense of like the nuance of character and the way they fit in here. It's really something.
It is.
All right. Well, that's Cabaret next week. And that is our musicals marathon.
It is, isn't it?
It is. So next week, breathe easy. No new marathon just yet. We'll hand out the gingers. Our best of the musicals marathon awards, and prepare you and ourselves for a 6-week Werner Herzog Klaus Kinski marathon.
Wow, you can't get much more different than going from musicals into
Herzog
Kinski.
Although from Cabaret, I mean, we stopped at the right place.
That's a good point.
We got the right country here. We stay in Germany.
Yeah, we do. We're going to have to bring in Magnus from Berlin to be our guide through this marathon, I think. After the break, boiler room on your top 5 movies about money list. Are you sure you want to stick with that, Sam? Your top 5 feedback is next, but first, some of your recent audio feedback.
Boys, boys, Anne in Jacksonville here. Loved your New York shows, loved your New York top 5, but I feel there was one glaring omission.
So now she's the one in the Mr. Softy ice cream truck who's trying to kill me. They're all trying to kill me. I mean, I just wanted to leave, you know, my apartment, maybe meet a nice girl. And now I've got to die for it?
That's right, Martin Scorsese's After Hours. How could you leave that off? Enjoyed the rest of it, just wanted to share that thought. Thanks.
Adam, Sam, it's Jason from Sacramento. I was wondering if you guys considered a simple plan for your movies about money. It's not the feel-good movie of the year, but, you know, kind of like Fargo. Really painful at the end, but it was a good movie nonetheless.
I didn't say don't do it, babe, when she packed up to go. I didn't say come back here, honey, and we'll try it once more. And when she asked me if I loved her, I just looked away. She is gone, and now I'm hearing all the things I didn't say. I didn't say I'm sorry, because half the fault was mine. And I didn't say we'll work it out, because all we need is love, faith, and time. I said if that's the way you want it, I will stand in your way. She is gone, and now I'm hearing all the things I didn't say.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound,
a mark, a yen,
a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go around, that clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round.
Welcome back to Cinecast with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and there it is, Sam, the song you were mentioning, of course, from Cabaret, tying in perfectly with our feedback here in this
song segment.
Movies about money. You got to play Money Makes the World Go Round.
A well-oiled machine.
Yes, we are a well-oiled machine, exactly. Some voicemails there of note. Anne mentioned After Hours. Sam, I knew After Hours would come up as a Scorsese film.
I don't know why.
It was on my short list.
I don't know how that didn't make it. And not only mentioning After Hours, but really a wonderfully produced
piece. And did a nice job.
Yeah, nice job.
And we certainly agree, even though I have to acknowledge Cinecast Confession, never seen the entire film. I feel terrible about it. I've never watched the whole film.
I absolutely love it. And credit to you.
Yeah. I it's one of those films that would always come on late at night, like on HBO or Cinemax or something, and I'd always see parts of, but never the entire film. So I definitely need to get to it. Also, we had one there, Jason mentioning A Simple Plan. Boy, Sam, Jason was not alone here. We're going to get to...
No, he wasn't. He asks if he was alone. No.
Yeah. I mean, someone else is going to mention this as well. We'll get to some of their feedback. But A Simple Plan, the Sam Raimi film, definitely came up a lot. Like I said, we'll get into that a little bit more here in a moment. One other quick one to acknowledge that we weren't able to play, but Ed in England mentioned top five Bill Paxton movies. He was going back and getting caught up on shows, and we did our top five Bill Paxton roles, and he mentioned Near Dark with Bill Paxton playing a vampire. A couple people wrote in with Near Dark. I have not seen it, Sam. Have you?
I haven't, and I mean, just to be clear, we didn't actually devote an entire top five segment to Bill Paxton, which would surprise our Cinecast listeners.
It was a tie-in. Yes, there.
Yeah.
So, one quick note I want to make before we get into the feedback, Sam, is just that marathon note. You said it. We're done with the musicals marathon. We're going to take a week off, so to speak. We're going to kind of analyze what we did through the past 6 weeks next week and get ready for the Herzog marathon. But if you haven't gone to our marathons page at the Cinecast show site, you can see actually our next three marathons are planned out. Herzog Kinski, then a screwball comedies marathon, and then a documentaries marathon. So the next 18 weeks of Cinecast marathons are planned out if you want to click on the marathons link.
Will we be here? Maybe not,
exactly.
The marathon movies will be.
You can at least play along at home if you want. Okay, well, let's get into the feedback then, Sam. Let's get started. Okay. Movies about money.
Yeah, this one's from Jeff Houston, who writes, how on earth can you explain having a top five movies about money list and not have it include John Huston's masterful The Treasure of Sierra Madre? I shouldn't even have to be asking this question. My gripe should be, why isn't it number one, not why isn't it even on the list? If the reason it's not there is because neither of you have seen it, then you had better come up with a marathon topic that includes it ASAP. No film captures the sadistic spirit of greed as potently and memorably as this Bogart classic. Jeff Houston.
In Tulsa, Oklahoma. Thank you for that, Jeff. Jeff was also another person who mentioned A Simple Plan, the Sam Raimi film. But Treasure of the Sierra Madre, we've also got this one from Brian Richmond in Sacramento, California. He says, semi-longtime listener, first-time writer, top five money films. Honorable mention, Run Lola Run, a good choice. Number five, The Bicycle Thief, which was on my list. Number four, The Road Warrior. Number three, Yojimbo, the most mercenary film ever with a master swordsman risking his neck for cash that has no meaning for him. Number two, City Lights. This is a great choice with the tramp, of course, played by Charlie Chaplin. And his number one as well, Treasure of the Sierra Madre. I can hear you groaning from here. Don't worry. I'm not going to bust your chops for this oversight. But when I think of greed, I'm not thinking of Gordon Gekko. I'm thinking of Fred Dobbs. That's from Brian in Sacramento. And Brian and Jeff were most certainly not alone. Sam,
yeah,
is
Jay
it time?
Oaks, I've got, yeah.
Yeah, do we
oh,
just
yeah,
have to have
admit,
a Cinecast confession?
Do we do it simultaneously?
We've never seen
it. Haven't seen it, yeah.
The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
I mean, isn't my thinking of the wrong film? Isn't Treasure of the Sierra Madre a screwball comedy? I think you'll see it
right
in our next marathon.
Well, Humphrey Bogart appears somewhere, I'm sure, in our marathon or a marathon.
Sure,
so we can
right
justify the Sierra Madre.
We'll justify it.
We need
we'll
to see it. I told Jeff it is right at the top now of my queue. I plan on checking it out very soon. I know you will too, Sam. Because we're shamed.
I absolutely will, I promise. Okay. We are very shamed, yeah. It's
Mike,
not clear.
Yeah, Mike in Omaha says, hey, Adam and Sam, when I first heard about the Movies About Money top five, only one movie popped into my head, Brewster's Millions. Richard Pryor is hilarious in a story where he finds himself in a position where he has to spend $30 million in 30 days without owning anything in the end in order to inherit $300 million. I don't know what it is about this movie, but while I worked at a video store for a couple years in college, this flick wound up on the in-store TVs more times than I can count. Keep up the good work, Mike in Omaha. Now, Sam, because of
I almost thought he was joking.
No, yes. He's not. Because of your upbringing, you probably never saw Brewster's Millions.
Well, no, in fact, I did see it. And, I mean, I don't know if I'd put it in the same school as, Fast Times at Ridgemont High or something like that. And I have very specific memories of it. And I think I would have thought that Michael was joking, except that we got an email from Robert Young, who said, you know, I just listened to your 5-3-1 Best Movies About Money and was disgusted.
Yeah.
That Brewster's Millions was not on your list. You need to go have a good hard think about yourself for that one.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Sam, I remember.
I love
remember,
that film. I do.
You do?
I do.
Did you consider it?
I actually think it did make the short list of, you know, like the top 30 or something. But it's one of those, I mean, it's a guilty pleasure.
Candy's in that too, right?
Yeah, John Candy. You have to feel a little bit guilty about it. But I have to tell you that nothing warmed my heart more. No email warmed my heart more than getting those emails from people saying Brewster's Millions. I mean, that is so great because I watched that movie 100 times when I was a kid. I loved it.
I feel like this is a film we were talking about, Quick Change, last week.
Yeah.
Where it's like I saw it and I was 10 and I was like, pretty lousy.
Really?
You know, it's like, that's not really up to snuff. I mean, I have certain comedic standards. And Brewster's Millions.
Hey,
was
Richard
not
Pryor.
Hit it.
Yeah. Richard Pryor being a minor league baseball pitcher is comedy. I mean, that's.
Or sending. I do remember him. I think this is what may have sealed the deal for him. You know, buying a priceless stamp and then sending it in the mail, making it immediately worthless.
Yeah, exactly. That's what the whole movie's
good
about.
Memories.
It's good stuff.
Good
it's a great film. If by great I mean
it's a great film.
If by great I mean maybe so bad it's great. Okay,
it's time to revisit Brewster's Millions, obviously, and The Toy.
Richard Pryor marathon. Hey, I loved The Toy when I was a kid too. Don't knock The Toy. Andy Hall writes in, Sam, put down the crack pipe and step away. You decided to be contrarian and say that you didn't like West Side Story, and I'll just say that pretensions got the best of you when it came to the Umbrellas of Cherbourg. But Boiler Room, oh come on. Did you want one movie that was a complete turd fest in your list? And to put it on the same list as the movie it so poorly, sadly, badly rips off, Glengarry Glen Ross, for shame. What should have been on the list instead? I can think of dozens, but the one that keeps popping up in my mind is A Simple Plan. Three guys find $4 million in a crash plane that nobody is coming for, and all they have to do is wait, and they can't. Not only do you see how the money corrupts Bridget Fonda, destroys the souls of Billy Bob Thornton and Bill Paxton, but Gary Cole is amazing as pure evil. Forget Spider-Man. This is Sam Raimi's best movie. Boiler Room? Are you sure? Are you sure you want to stick with that?
It's true. I was playing Where in the World is the Piece of Turd in my top five list, and I'm glad Andy Hall was the only one to find it.
He was.
I'm so disappointed. Andy Hall, we've actually mentioned this, I think, briefly, Adam, Simple Plan. I think we actually have similar feelings about Simple Plan. It didn't appear on either of our lists.
For the reason
that,
it's
not very good.
I don't think it's that great.
I don't think Raimi has a real good sense. I mean, when I talk about Spider-Man, I feel like Raimi's finally rediscovered the joy of movie making that he had obviously with the Evil Dead films. And it doesn't exist, I don't think. There's no fun in A Simple Plan. It's actually kind of boring.
Yeah.
That's what I remember of it.
You know,
this is a fun topic, but
I don't remember much except, of course, it being a very unsettling film in terms of these people. You know that they're just going to constantly hurt themselves. What they're going to do is undermine all of their best intentions. And that's kind of hard to watch. But I don't think that's the only reason why I didn't like it. I have to say it was so long ago. You know, I saw it on video shortly after it came out. I can't remember exactly why it didn't do much for me, but I remember feeling like, wow, so that's sort of just a Coen Brothers ripoff in a way, but just a little bleaker.
But it also didn't have that tone, that sharp comic edge to it.
Yeah, but some of the performances are pretty decent in it, so.
Andy wasn't alone.
Yeah.
Ben Mon wrote in to support it, and our friend Magnus in Berlin wrote in. We're not reading his list, but I did want to point out that Magnus had a great title on his list that I really should have put on because I just saw it, Point Blank, with Lee Marvin.
Lee Marvin. Yeah, the John Borman film, right?
$19,000, John Borman.
Yeah.
Brilliant film. That should have been on my list.
Okay. Well, Sam, our last money email here, you did get someone with a rebuttal to Andy Hall.
Yeah, Boiler Room. I support you, Sam. John writes, I just wanted to support Sam on his pick of Boiler Room for his top five movies about money. I liked this movie a lot when I saw it and have revisited it a few times. This movie is all about money. I loved the scene. I love the scene when they're all in one of the guy's houses where the owner has only unpacked the couches and the TV, and they're watching Wall Street, and they're taking turns quoting it verbatim. This is classic stuff. Do you remember thinking that Vin Diesel would be a very good actor, a perfect example of how action movies can kill a career? Keep up the great work, guys.
Well, I'm sorry, but Andy was dead on.
God, you're wrong.
He was dead on.
You got to go check that out again. Ribisi is good.
Oh, he's so hard to watch in that film.
What's our favorite? Nicky Cat?
Yeah.
I think, in Boiler Room as well.
Okay. Well, I some of the performances work okay. I agree with Vin Diesel. Nicky Cat is always funny. And I do like the scene there.
What didn't you like about it? I don't remember.
Honestly, I felt just like what Andy said. It's a bad Glengarry Glen Ross knockoff. I mean, it just wasn't interesting.
Hey, if you're going to knock something off, knock off the best.
I suppose. But maybe that it's too good to even try to knock off, Sam. Let's get on to some other feedback here. Actually, speaking of that, Sam, should we just take a moment? It was funny that we got an email from Garrett in Wichita Falls, Texas, who wrote in and he said, "Okay, guys, I promise I will watch Glengarry," which we had both on our number one. It was our number one choice for movies about money. He says he'll finally watch it if we put it in the penalty box. That movie has to be the most mentioned movie on your show. Somehow it can be applied to almost any top five or genre. I've been meaning to watch it for a while now. I just keep bumping it back on my Netflix queue, but I promise you, I will go buy it this weekend and watch it. And if it doesn't live up to your praises, it's going to Peerflix, and maybe one of you guys can have it for a second copy at the office or something, so you can get your Glengarry fix anytime you want. Love the show. Keep up the good work. And I wrote back to
Garrett. Somebody didn't go back to the top five
list. Yeah, I wrote to Garrett, and I told him. I did the research, and Sam, even though it does come up a lot, because we both love it. The fact is, we've managed to really restrain ourselves. I think the last time it came up in a 6 through 10 on Cinecast number 63 on my list, last time it appeared before that, Cinecast number 19.
19 quotable movies.
In a top five quotable movies. So I think we've done pretty decent. And the good part is, Garrett, he lived up to his promise. He watched it over the weekend. He says it completely lived up to the hype. It deserves all the praises we've given it and probably more. I agree. You guys have shown a lot of restraint, not to mention it more. So that was very nice that all worked out well.
That's nice. And you know, and sort of in that line, funny email from Kevin Vasquez as well of Buena Park, California. Looking ahead to our top five movies about the American experience, let me try to guess what will be on your list. In America, Nashville, Bottle Rocket, Chinatown, All the President's Men, Roger Dodger, maybe A History of Violence, and throw in a Woody Allen movie? These are just a couple of guesses of what may be on your list.
I don't know what Kevin's talking about.
Somebody's getting top five fatigue.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's us or Kevin.
I don't know what he's talking about, but it is funny, Sam, isn't it, that like those seven films pretty much go at the top of any top five list we do, and then we have to bump them down because we know we mentioned them too much. Kevin's been paying attention. He's been doing a good job. So we do have some more information about not only our 100th episode, but the new name for Cinecast, which, Sam, we're finally going to unveil next week.
Next week,
we're going to reveal it to you. We're going to reveal the winner of the renamed Cinecast contest, which listener won the contest. And we're also going to give you a little bit more information about our 100th episode. We've got something really cool planned. Wouldn't you agree, Sam?
I am getting nervous.
Okay.
I'm nervous about the new name. Not that it's bad.
Yeah,
but just
it's not.
Being different.
I know. It's going to be tough. I think it's been so long since we've talked about it. People are like, oh, well, maybe they didn't have to change it. No, we did.
Yeah, we did.
And we'll announce it next week. If you've got feedback for us, send us an email or a short MP3 clip to cinecast@cinecastshow.com. You can also leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINE. That's 206-203-2463.
Time for another quick break. When we come back, I am not a Polak. People from Poland are Poles. They are not Polaks. But what I am is 100% American. I'm born and raised in the greatest country on earth, and I'm proud of it. We count down our top five movies about America next. Did you ever see the article in the satirical newspaper The Onion where a woman wakes up to find that her one-night stand's DVD collection is made up entirely of curiously banal titles like Driven, Tomcats, Swordfish, and My Blue Heaven? He invites her to stay and have breakfast, but she decides to leave when she sees a copy of Psycho with Vince Vaughn on his nightstand. Maybe your collection doesn't have such egregious embarrassments as that, and maybe you're not the kind of person that engages in one-off sexual affairs. And that's totally cool if you don't. My point is, take a look at your DVD collection. Maybe 97% of it is rock solid. It totally reflects your impeccable taste. You're a total rock star. Congratulations. But what about that extra copy of Apocalypse Now? You really going to watch The Redux again? maybe someone else could use it. Sign up for a PeerFlix account today and trade a DVD you've got for one you really want at peerflix.com/cinecast.
I look cute at the end of your leash. You're adorable beast as I salivate on your shoes. Obedient and true, loyal through and through, a fuzzy reflection of you. If you are wounded, I will lick it. If you feed me, I won't forget it. If I mess up, just rub my nose in it. You let me out to sniff around, do my business and stretch out, and I always come running when you call. I look cute at the end of your leash, you adorable beast.
I believe in America. America has made my fortune, and I raised my daughter in the American fashion.
Welcome back to Cinecast with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and it is now time for our top five movies about America or the American experience. I did, Sam, try to talk you out of this list at the last minute. I loved this suggestion we got from Hans Erhausen in Portland, Oregon, who said, top five pretentious movies, as defined by the dictionary, attempting to impress by affecting greater importance, talent, culture, etc., than is actually possessed. This could possibly cross over with our top five overrated films. When thinking of this category, American Beauty definitely comes to mind. I thought, since you also don't like American Beauty, I thought maybe you'd go for the pretentious movies list.
Another
opportunity to rip on it and infuriate our listeners. But maybe pretentious movies somewhere down the road. It certainly, I think, could almost tie in with American Dreams.
Sure, it could have. And it probably will find another reason in the future to rip on movies we hate, which really just makes people angry.
It does, but that's sometimes fun. We're always praising movies in our top five. Let's arouse some hatred. Why not?
Let's do that.
Okay, I'm sure we will. Before we get into our top five, I would like you, Sam, to briefly set up again the criteria that you used. Kind of what did you use to limit down your list?
Right. I mean, basically, anything is possible, willing to die for your dream, going it alone, and finally, no cowboys, no mobsters, no politicians, no satires, no cynicism.
Unbelievable.
And no in America.
Okay. Right. And no in America. That should be just a top five rule from now on. And your through 10, the ones that just missed your cut, Sam, you had great list here, I have to say. Coal Miner's Daughter, Yankee Doodle Dandy, American Movie, The New World, and Tucker, A Man and His Dream. Your number five is
Nostalgia File.
Yeah.
My number five is a movie that maybe should have made our top five movies about New York list, and that is Breakfast at Tiffany's, actually. It's sort of like what you realize later in the film, very late in the film, what we learn about Holly Golightly, that she's not who she appears to be, that she was originally Lula Mae Barnes, and her husband, her much older husband, played by Buddy Ebsen, comes and tries to collect her, and you realize what she's done is completely reinvent herself as a New York socialite, and certainly perfectly captures that idea of recreating your identity, certainly finding some peace of mind. The only place you can find peace is sort of sitting in front of at Tiffany's, the quietness and the proud look of it, and represents her idea of the American dream.
Okay.
For your 6 through 10, Adam, and when you heard my criteria, you basically said, well, just flip that around. Basically, that was your criteria. I mean, we will find politicians, cowboys, and mobsters, I think, in your list. Your 6 through 10, a pair of films here at the top, Easy Rider and Lost in America, then Roger and Me, Grapes of Wrath, The Manchurian Candidate, and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yeah, I did try, unlike you, to kind of pick movies that pinpointed a certain time or place in American history or said something about a very specific moment. And maybe if someone from another country or aliens came down and wanted to know America, maybe this would give them some insight. And again, I'm really looking forward to hearing from some of our foreign listeners about what movies they think define America for them. The first choice on my list, though, in my number five movie, is maybe the only one that really doesn't probably meet that criterion only because it's probably more about the human race rather than saying something specific about America. But I've really been looking for an opportunity to mention this film, and it's actually Errol Morris's documentary Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. You've got four different characters that he focuses on here, real people, obviously, in a documentary. A lion tamer, a topiary gardener, someone who's fascinated by mole rats, and an MIT scientist who's working with complex robots. And again, it ends up being more probably about the human experience and this obsessive need to better ourselves and just obsession in general, people becoming fascinated and just taken away with something that for other people seems bizarre or at least seems like, you know, a hobby at best. I mean, if you look at the Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control website, they mention that it starts as a darkly funny contemplation on the Sisyphus-like nature of human striving, but becomes a profoundly moving meditation on the very nature of existence. I think it probably does pull that off, but at the very least, like I said, I think if someone was to come down and want a snapshot of human evolution and these people striving for some kind of perfection and greatness out of something, I mean, they're all four Americans. Again, it probably doesn't meet the criteria very well, but I really wanted to pick that movie. Yeah. So I think that it does somehow match or give you a perspective on a certain time and place.
Yeah, and you're what you described as the film being described on its website could have easily described American movie as well. When you talk about some, you know, that was in my 6 through 10, uh-huh. Somebody totally obsessed with,
yeah.
You know, spending all of their time on something that to the rest of us seems a waste of time. But mm-hmm. Moving on to my number 4, Quiz Show, Robert Redford. Here you have somebody that actually has been, you know, born into what many people would see as the American dream. You know, Ralph Fiennes as Charles Van Doren at this very academic family, and he himself being a very good-looking college professor seemingly has it all. But when given the chance to make some dough and get some fame and some celebrity on 21, what you get is somebody corrupted by the American dream in some way. And you see, you know, John Turturro's Herbert Stempel character denied his American dream in mm-hmm. some way, or, you know, once he had his taste of it. Sort of the corruptive power
sure.
Of the American dream there.
Great pick. My number 4 is a movie I don't think has appeared for either of us on a top 5. I'm quite certain you probably hate the film, Sam. We've never talked about it, but it is a film I really like, and it's actually Pleasantville. Mm. I think you've got a film here that, again, sort of tries to tell this story about a certain passage of American history. And it's also very much like a movie that didn't make my list, but a movie like Forrest Gump, which, as you know, I like more than you do. And I think one of the reasons it works is because it's almost more about our history being told through movies than it is about our actual history. You get a lot of moments like that, great references to Kill a Mockingbird. And it kind of uses those cultural milestones as guiding points for its way, its version of events that it tells here, kind of the courtroom scene, of course, from To Kill a Mockingbird. But I think that it again is telling this moment in American history where not only do you have actually the present day, and I think it does a really believable job of setting up why a character like Tobey Maguire living in the 90s or whatever would actually be fascinated by the simplicity of life and the integrity, really, on some level of life back in the 50s. And then again, you get this. You get America through the eyes of how it used to be or how it could have been, whether it was actually really that way. It's at least the way television told it. I think it's a good movie, even though I do think that, you know, Gary Ross, he's never met a metaphor he didn't want to beat into the ground.
I was going to say, yeah, it overreaches
and,
a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, it does a little bit, you know, and you've got, of course, the moment where a teenager actually reaches for an apple out of
the
tree.
It's brutal.
But with that said, that's brutal. Yeah. I'll give you that. And yet I like that idea of Don Knotts' character actually being God. I think it's a really interesting idea of him being God and saying, you can live in this paradise, this Eden that is Pleasantville, or you can choose to have knowledge. Nice little biblical, you know, reference there. And they, of course, choose knowledge. And I think great performances, too. Joan Allen, Tobey Maguire, Reese Witherspoon William H. Macy. I think they're all good. I like Pleasantville.
No, I do too. I actually do like it a lot more than you might suggest.
Okay.
I do. But my number 3, you know, following along in this, you know, going after the American dream here, a film we both love from last year, Hustle and Flow, Craig Brewer, you know, where maybe it's not true that only in America, you know, a pimp can, you know, can have the dream mm-hmm. of, you know, digging himself out of his present circumstances, but it's absolutely true. And in fact, not only can he, you know, put that past behind him, he can use his pimpdom as leverage, in fact, celebrate that lifestyle in some way in order to get himself out. And I think that is uniquely American. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, I think that's a great pick. Definitely keeps with what you were going for with your list. My number three is one that was just on your list, Sam, Quiz Show. And you explained it really well, this idea of the corruptive nature maybe of the American dream. But it fit perfectly with what I was going for as well in terms of, again, telling this specific moment in time during this game show craze that started back in the 50s. But I think you do have to talk about it in terms of this loss of innocence. Maybe, again, you've got Redford overreaching a little bit in trying to pinpoint. I mean, any filmmaker could pick any decade and find a moment that tells America's loss of innocence, probably. You know what I mean? And so this is right. Just one he's picked. This is from the 50s. And you've got this moment, but I think it really does explain that time well. And I think that what's interesting about the film is it does say something about America in the sense that you've got a guy in Richard Goodwin, this lawyer character, who's trying to bring down the bad guys, bring down the people who are running these TV networks and who really did something wrong. And of course, what ends up working out is that someone gets scapegoated. And the person who probably has the most integrity through this entire process is the one that actually ends up getting hurt the most by it. Somehow that seems, maybe it's not uniquely American, but it seems like it to me. So yeah, Quiz Show is on my list.
My number two, a film I love, Big Night, which is sort of the immigrant story in some way. And you have in the film, directed by Stanley Tucci and Campbell Scott, starring Stanley Tucci and Tony Shalhoub as Primo and Secondo, these Italian brothers that start a restaurant. And I don't know if we ever know exactly where they are, but I imagine they're in Jersey, I think, probably just outside the city. And really what they have at the end of the film is the near fulfillment of the American fantasy in some way, where they're celebrating everything that's wonderful and powerful about their heritage with the food, that amazing buffet mm-hmm. of food that is that's laid out, and also the hope of fame and celebrity. You know, with Louis Prima is going to come and he is going to make the restaurant and he's going to make the brothers. He's going to put them on the map. And then, of course, what you do is have that dream, you know, yanked out from underneath him. And what mm-hmm. you have is just like the desperation of what it means to be scrabbling, you know, for a yeah. place in American society as an immigrant. And Ian Holm, you know, as the Pascal figure, you know, bite your teeth into the ass of life, you know, sort of has totally embraced the American aesthetic in terms of capitalism and will do anything. I mean, what does Tony Shalhoub's character say? Something about what happens at Pascal's restaurant. It's rape. It's a rape. It's the rape of cuisine.
Uh-huh.
You know, but that's something. But he has an empire, a food empire, and the brothers are going to. Their restaurant is going to close, and you know, they're probably going to go back to Italy, or one of them is. And so it really, you know, embodies that sort of like that the crux of living the fantasy, mm-hmm. and you know, being completely burnt by it as well.
Yeah, that's a great choice too. I like Big Night a lot. My number two, one that people can probably see coming right up Main Street, the one constant through all the years, Sam, has been baseball. America has rolled by like an army of steamrollers. It has been erased like a blackboard, rebuilt and erased again. But baseball has marked the time, this field, this game. It's a part of our past, Sam. It reminds us of all that was once good, and it could be again. You know, I had to put Field of Dreams on because
yes.
it is,
I just
of
got
course, yes, I'm sure,
that.
Do my James Earl Jones. It is, of course, about baseball, which is American. But as I've said before on this show, I don't think there's anything actually more American. Forget apple pie and the flag in baseball than fathers and sons and conflict between fathers and sons, which is the crux of that entire film, that disagreement between the father and son, the splitting, the rebellion sort of from his teen years. And then all he wants later in life is to have that chance to have a catch with his dad. I think I'm a tear is falling
You're
right
tearing.
Now, Sam.
Yeah, I am. I'm alone in a booth in Brooklyn, and
yeah.
I'm weeping openly.
It's a beautiful film. There's actually a nice thread in our message boards on the Cinecast Show site about movies that make men cry, and Field of Dreams
yes.
has come up
absolutely
quite a few times. It's my number two.
It's a great pick, and I should have probably said no cowboys, no mobsters, no politicians, no baseball
you
players.
You should have said
because,
that.
Because you could have picked any number of
That's true.
Baseball films.
Mm-hmm.
Pride of the Yankees, I considered just for that one moment.
Well, you've got the corruption, too, certainly of a film like Eight Men Out. You can go a lot of ways. Yeah,
61, even, and forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, it brings us to my number one, which really is the closest I get to sort of abandoning my criteria, and it's The Right Stuff. Because, I mean, what you have really are space cowboys. You have men who, you know, these fighter pilots who, in their race to, you know, be the first men in space, you know, are uniquely American characters, cocky and tough and ambitious and competitive. And just for the reward of being first, they're willing to sacrifice their lives. And I mean, we talk, you know, the rest of this list has all been about reinvention and pursuing a dream despite your past. And for these men, it's really, I mean, the dream could not be more clear.
Yeah.
And it's something certainly we can all relate to.
Yeah, Sam, you're really annoying because...
No, you didn't.
Yeah, I did. My number one film, of
course.
So our
lists converge. It's actually a poetic...
Yeah, it is. They start out with completely different ideas in mind. They all end up at the right stuff. Probably the only one for me, too, that falls into that category of truly patriotic. I think maybe some of our listeners thought maybe that's where we were even going. For example, you can put a lot, you know, any war movie on a list that makes America look good in terms of, you know, again, from some kind of patriotic aspect. But this is the one for me that really does fall into that category of making you almost proud to be an American. You know, we weren't first maybe in space. Sputnik beat us, but we did it the best, you know, and we pushed it further. And you're right. There is something about that American spirit of trying to conquer space, really, and beat the Russians, which again falls into this category for me of a very specific time and place when that was somehow relevant. We had to beat, I mean, the classic moment of the guy running down the hallway, the Russians are in space, and they then are determined to get there. And I think what's also funny, Sam, is I swear to God that you used that space cowboy idea, and the moment you mentioned that you didn't use any cowboys on your list, and you said that you might see some on my list, I wrote next to the right stuff. Well, they're essentially cowboys. Astronauts are cowboys. That's the whole idea. So you're dead on. It's
Final Frontier.
It's one of my favorite films, probably of all time. A nostalgia pick, but a film that doesn't have to just be a nostalgia pick. Makes you proud on some level to be an American. I love the performances, Ed Harris, especially Dennis Quaid as Gordo Cooper. It's a great film.
It's a great, great film. All right. Well, that is a fine way to wrap up our top five, and that is our show. Please send any feedback to cinecast@cinecastshow.com or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at cinecastshow.com. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Cinecast. Also, on our blog, sign up for The Dope Sheet, the Cinecast weekly email blast. In this week's edition, Adam suggested an overlooked New York movie to check out on DVD. Next week, I'll deliver an overlooked DVD pick of my own.
Opening this weekend, Aquila and the Bee, RV with Robin Williams, and United 93 from director Paul Greengrass, which Sam and I will review on our next show. Plus, we'll reveal our top five movies about heroes, of course tying in with United 93, or at least acts of heroism. I got to tell you, though, Sam, I'm nervous about this top five again as well.
Sure.
I haven't started yet, and I told you I was nervous about movies about America, and then I ended up leaving 20 films off my list. So we'll see. Maybe maybe I can get this one, too, of course. Start sending in your ideas.
To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, it's a lock. It's not a compelling
Atticus Finch is a hero, right? Thanks to Bobby Bear Jr. and Bloodshot Records for today's music. Please check them out on the web at bloodshotrecords.com. For Cinecast, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Hallgren. Thanks for listening. Cinecast is presented by PureFlix. Swap the DVDs you have for the ones you really want at PureFlix.com/Cinecast. And also buy the new Honda Fit. The Fit is go. Immensely strong, impossibly roomy, implausibly versatile. The 5-door, 5-passenger Fit, inspired by all things powerful beyond their size. Get your high-octane piston-pumping thrills from a gas-sipping, low-emissions vehicle, a lean, mean, clean machine that delivers 38 miles per gallon on the freeway. Burn, baby, burn. Learn more on the web at fit.honda.com.